Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back our great guest co-host, Laurel Sisler. Welcome, Laurel.
Thanks for having me.
We've got some great things on our show today, and it's a great conversation that we're going to have with the author of a new book, Dizziness, Why You Feel Dizzy, and What Will Help You Feel Better, Dr. Greg Whitman. Looking forward to hearing that conversation.
Yeah, me too.
Well, first, though, we have some really interesting research that matters, and let's dive right in, which is an article about actually do foreign medical graduates give the same type of care as U.S. graduates, something that's maybe not intuitive.
Yeah, this was a study looking at the impact of care given by foreign graduate medical students versus those who got their residency and all that here in the U.S. And looking at Medicare patients specifically, so patients near the end of life, so found that 11.2% of the Medicare patients cared for by foreign graduates died within 30 days of being admitted to the hospital, compared to 11.6% cared for by those U.S. graduates. Slightly lower rate of death among those cared for by the foreign graduates.
So the hypothesis actually that it may have been that, well, it could be worse that the foreign medical graduates, and these are people who went to medical school outside the United States, but came here probably for residency, similar to our graduates of U.S. medical schools and go to residency. And, you know, I think some people might be going, what? The care could be a little better, which is this data was based on 1.2 million hospital admissions of Medicare patients between 2011 and 2014 among over 44,000 primary care internists. What could be going on here? It doesn't necessarily mean they're better doctors. They could be. But are there other things that could be going on?
Yeah, my thought, and the authors talk about this too, is that the criteria for selecting one of these foreign medical students would be a little bit higher. So maybe the standards are a little bit higher for them. And then they also point out another possible cultural factor, which is that they might be more likely to get consultation just because they're not totally sure of the cultural things that might be impacting their care.
There's also a lot of the foreign graduates who might have done a residency back in their home country, and then they have to get into our residency programs, they actually may have to do a second residency. I've seen this a number of times. I had an Argentinian physician just like that. He's already been practiced 4 or 5 years, comes back here and does another residency. It's like you get
people
a double residency.
Experience.
A lot of experience there. And so I think that's a huge factor. A take-home message for me is if someone's a good doctor, they're a good doctor, and regardless of where they've trained, and most of our foreign medical graduates that come practice here are probably in that category, just as are the graduates of the U.S. medical schools.
Yep, I agree.
Very excited. Well, let's talk about our next research that matters, which really has to do with delayed gratification in these original experiments that the kids who were able to delay the gratification seem to have done better in life. But this is some new research.
Yeah, it is a new research coming out of the University of Chicago School of Business, actually. And I think it's really interesting because they're pointing out that it's not really that painstaking process of having to wait for delayed gratification. But in fact, if you can find enjoyment in the process, whatever it is you're trying to work on, whether it's weight loss or some other goal, it's actually if you can find the enjoyment along the way that you tend to be a lot more successful.
Yeah, they said it was the delaying gratification, those original research studies, but it's not. And this was published in the journal Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin. I like that name. And it really suggests that when you delay something, perhaps those who are successful are actually getting a reward, but that reward is right there. And I love the idea, you know, someone who's studying really hard perhaps to get into medical school and they're going to have to study really hard week after week, month after month, year after year, they're able to say, you know what, I did really good on a test. I think I can do this. And there's this like this positive reinforcement that you get. And so that helps us think about perhaps people who need to, let's say, lose weight.
Yeah.
they're not going to lose weight, right, for weeks and weeks maybe, but there could be something immediately they're going to get positive benefits from.
Yeah, I think about it with like lots of crash diets and things that might have results in the short term, but really the people who are successful in the long term at not just losing weight but keeping it off are find some enjoyment in the process.
Yeah, they call it discovering gratification in every situation. I like that.
I do too.
What about this next research that matters? This is about low gluten diets and higher risk of diabetes. No, I didn't say that wrong. Low gluten diets and higher risk of diabetes. You know anyone who's following low gluten diets, Laurel?
Yes, a lot of people. It's kind of all the rage now is to try to limit your gluten or cut it out altogether. And this study is showing that, you know, looking at risk for type 2 diabetes in particular, maybe actually limiting your gluten is not the right thing to do.
Yeah, this seems like, I know there's lots of listeners out there going to go, huh? And this is not for people who are truly gluten sensitive, but the great majority of people who are on gluten-free diets aren't necessarily gluten sensitive. And this was an observational study that was presented at the American Heart Association's Metabolic Summit recently. And they really looked at those who were in a gluten intake that was below kind of what we might consider kind of a cutoff or a higher gluten diet. And within that group, those who were having the higher end rather than the lower end of the low gluten diet had actually lower rates of diabetes, which suggests that, well, this is interesting. I mean, they said it could be something like maybe to fiber intake?
I don't fully understand the how this is possible because the examples they give are typically things that aren't high in fiber, although they can be. Pastas, cereal, pizza, muffins, generally things that I would not recommend for preventing type 2 diabetes. So I don't fully understand it.
Well, and it may not be cause and effect, but it may suggest, I think, that if you don't have a reason to be on a low-gluten diet and that and you maybe have some risk of diabetes, which is probably a lot of people, mm-hmm. that perhaps the low gluten diet may not be beneficial or as beneficial as thought. I think there needs to be a lot more research, but I find that kind of interesting. Let's talk about our very last research that matters about vending machines. What you ever get anything from a vending machine?
Very rarely.
You're so healthy. You're like starving and trying to get down to clinic and you run by the vending machine and the only thing is there are the baked Lay's potato chips and a Diet Coke.
Yeah.
But if you did go by there and there were choices between the Lay's potato chips and some yogurt and a Diet Coke or a water, what would help you choose the yogurt and the water? That's the question that they were looking at.
Yeah, and they were kind of hypothesizing that price would actually be the thing that would really influence people. So, you know, lower price pushing people towards more nutritious choices, but found that that wasn't actually the case. With drinks, the price did impact people's behavior, but with snacks, it was more about actually what was in the machine, so stocking, and then also signage, so promotional signs, things like low sugar and low fat.
So you mean if the only thing in the vending machine is a bag of raisins and then there's like 25 other things of different types of foods, that they may not pick the raisins. But if there's raisins and nuts and yogurt and granola, I mean, a lot of different things, people – and there's a sign that says look to think about healthier foods. People are much more likely to do that, particularly if maybe the price is not higher. I don't think it has to be significantly lower, but it shouldn't be higher.
I think that's right. That's what they're saying. It's kind of interesting because there was another study recently out of UNC School of Public Health showing that there's no merit in any of those signage about low fat, low sugar, low calorie, things like that, that they don't actually have any impact on true nutritional quality. So this is an interesting study, but I would not start buying snacks based on their labels.
And you know what people were buying, what beverage they were buying with the signage? Designer water.
Yeah.
I felt, okay, you're going to get me to do a healthier drink, but it's water, and it's the designer water. I could go to the water faucet and get some water
for
really free there. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. Stay with us, but we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be hearing from the author of a new book about dizziness, Dr. Greg Whitman, about what to do when the room starts spinning. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with co-author of a new book on dizziness, Dr. Greg Mittman, about why you feel dizzy and what will help you feel better. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Whitman.
Thanks.
You know, we're really thrilled. You are an instructor at Harvard Medical School. You're an accomplished neurologist. You really work with really advanced patients. And I must say, I'm thrilled to have you talk about one of the most common problems affecting all primary care, dizziness. We're thrilled.
Well, thanks for having me.
And let me just, before we get in, to say what prompted you to specialize in something that really everyone in the world's going to ask you questions about. How did you get interested in neurology?
Well, I think it's natural as a human being to be interested in the mind and the brain. And I think most neurologists are first attracted to understanding the brain, and then as you get into it, you start to learn about other things like the spine and the nerves. But it's an essential aspect of being human, the brain and the ability to think. And in my case, one of the most important things is the ability to move. It is really at the heart of my specialty, the ability to have balance and be able to walk and feel oriented. And that these are all really critical and essential parts of neurology. Neurology, I think, is also a developing specialty. I think it's lagged behind the scientific development of other specialties. So it's sort of exciting that when I was a college and medical student anyway, that's the way I was thinking, that there's probably a lot left to discover in neurology.
And so when we talk about dizziness, which is the book that you've written, tell us what systems are involved. I think a lot of people would be surprised, I know I am as a provider, at how much it takes to be balanced.
Yeah, it's true that it doesn't take much to disturb balance. Like as an example, almost any brain disorder or disease you can think of, a stroke or a brain tumor or multiple sclerosis or almost anything you can think of that has to do with the brain will disturb balance. But it's, at the same time, your ability to maintain normal balance is amazingly protected by redundant systems. You've got your visual system, and you've got the inner ears providing information about motion and orientation, and you've got nerves from the arms and legs in your body telling you how you're oriented in space. And so you've really got a lot of redundant information. So on the one hand, yes, it takes a lot to have perfect balance. But I've also, the more I've been involved in this, been struck by how resilient people are, that in order for someone to come into my clinic with a major problem of balance and walking, there really has to kind of be more than one thing wrong. There have to be multiple systems that aren't working. Otherwise, the person probably would have compensated. It's balance by nature is a multi-sensory, multi-system, integrative sort of system and with a lot of redundancy built in. It's really very amazing when you think about it.
So when we talk about dizziness, one of the things I find most challenging is it seems like everyone has a slightly different definition. How do we define dizziness, and how do we do it in such a way that we encompass very broad definitions that it seems like different patients have?
Yeah, so that's right. Dizziness as a term is fairly, I don't want to say vague, but it's a fairly generic term that includes vertigo, which is an illusion of movement or spinning, lightheadedness or faintness, any other kind of spatial disorientation, as well as really in the United States, we also include problems with balance and walking, and all of these are subsumed under this term dizziness. So it's, you have to probably say more than I'm dizzy to describe what's going on.
Well, I assume it's, at least just based on my limited experience, that it is one of the more common problems that people go to the doctor with. Is that the case, and is it true that it would be across culture, or is it more specific to, let's say, Western culture?
It's extremely common. In the United States, it's been estimated that it's, I forget how many million, but it's millions of clinic visits per year for dizziness in the United States. And, you know, some of the best information on the prevalence or frequency of dizziness in the general population comes from this telephone interview study that they've been doing in Germany for a number of years, where they randomly call up ordinary people living in the community and ask them a bunch of medical questions after consenting them. And they found extremely high prevalence of dizziness that, you know, I would almost say it'd be very hard to be in a group of two or three people and talk to them in detail and not find one of them that had some kind of dizziness at some point in their life.
So when we talk about what causes dizziness, I also think back to, that it seems like you could learn most of medicine by studying what can cause dizziness. How do you go about teaching that to learners? Because perhaps that may be helpful for listeners to understand how an expert like yourself thinks about dizziness.
Well, one of the approaches that we used in the book is to try to make a list of the most common kinds of dizziness that we see in our specialized dizziness clinics. And when I say we, I mean Dr. Bailo and I. And what happens in my clinic is that there are a few things that we see over and over again, you know, practically every clinic day. Benign positional vertigo is one that we could talk about. Migraine is extremely common. And so one of the strategies that I use is to try to, you know, first determine whether the person I'm seeing has any of the common disorders and fits it perfectly. And if something doesn't fit perfectly, then I start getting worried that something else is going on. And by the way, I would also say that many people in dizziness specialty clinics have more than one diagnosis or more than one disorder. But to answer your original question, I think one of the ways to detect or how to teach how to detect other disorders is to know what the common disorders are and what their patterns are, what the symptoms are, how people feel. And if things are not fitting together as one of the common ones, then you have to, you know, click into sort of general medicine mode. And I do the best I can to do that. And if I can't figure out what the unusual heart or liver or kidney disease is, I need help from someone like you that knows general medicine.
We're talking with Dr. Gregory Whitman, instructor at Harvard Medical School, about his new book, Dizziness, Why You Feel Dizzy and What Will Help You Feel Better. And Dr. Whitman, you know, I think that one of the things that scares doctors if they've been around long enough is things like brain cancers that could present with dizziness. How do you start? Because I would imagine at the back of most patients who come into doctor with dizziness, they perhaps are worried about either a tumor or a stroke. Is that a wrong thing to be worried about?
Yeah. Is it anything serious? That's the question that a lot of people ask. And yeah, those are reasonable concerns. And in a person with undiagnosed dizziness, it could be almost anything. And unfortunately, the real answer is that it's a lot of pattern recognition, that someone comes into my dizziness clinic beyond the fact that they don't just have benign positional vertigo. It's not only spinning when they lie down and turn to their right side. And beyond the fact that it's not one-sided hearing loss like in Meniere's disease, there are other elements that just don't fit with the norm of the common disorders. The person might have had a personality change if they have a brain tumor. Typically, if you've got an expanding mass inside the brain, there are multiple neurological symptoms and signs that the person will experience and that will be evident. And so that's the way I recognize some of those more serious disorders, is that the pattern that I see when I talk to the person includes a sort of an array of different neurological symptoms. It's more complicated.
So if someone comes into an orthopedist, for example, with shoulder pain, I think it's hard to get out of that orthopedist's office without a shoulder x-ray. Is the same true with dizziness? Do people almost always get things like CAT scans or not really?
Well, not in our clinics. I think the key is follow-up. So if a person comes to a specialized dizziness clinic and complains of a set of symptoms that perfectly matches some disorder that we understand very well. You know, I lie down to my right side and the world spins, and then the doctor does a test and lies the person down to their right side, and there's a 20-second burst of, you know, jerking eye movements that we call nystagmus, and everything's just perfect. Then if there aren't any other symptoms or signs, the person's not becoming cognitively impaired, their right arm is not becoming paralyzed, there's nothing else to suggest some other disorder, then typically I'll treat for what I think is going on and then follow the person just to make sure that, you have it right. I think that's a key aspect that sometimes is overlooked, is it's important to follow up on people and make sure you've got it right.
Well, that's really, really great advice, and one that I'm sure our listeners appreciate. We're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Greg Whitman, co-author of the new book on dizziness, about what to do when the room starts spinning. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we've been talking with co-author of the book Dizziness, Dr. Greg Whitman, instructor at Harvard Medical School, about what to do when the room starts spinning. And right before the break, Dr. Whitman, you did a really nice job, I think, of laying out both the serious possibilities and the things that aren't as serious. But I think to every patient, when you're feeling really dizzy, you feel kind of sick. And you talked about kind of time sometimes and getting it right. Tell us about maybe some of these conditions that you've talked about. Let's pick one, this benign positional vertigo that you mentioned. Tell us about a patient that maybe comes to you with that, and how does that look, act, and feel?
Well, Adam, the typical patient with benign positional vertigo will come to me explaining that with certain position changes, they experience a wave or a burst of dizziness, usually with an aspect of vertigo, meaning that they feel as though the room is moving or spinning, sometimes with a visually apparent jumping of the visual scene, turn over in bed and the alarm clock looks like it's jumping up and down. And the common triggering position changes are lying down, turning over in bed, sitting up in bed, or looking up. So that's typical person says, when I lie down or turn to the right or look up, there's this brief wave of dizziness. And then on top of that, there's a sort of a more lingering, vague, hard to describe dizziness that may be present throughout the day. But the worst of it has to do with getting up in and out of bed and looking up, position changes.
And I know that we sometimes try to, we call it benign because I guess it doesn't cause cancer, but it really can be incapacitating. What reassurance do you really offer?
Well, the best reassurance I can offer usually is that I'm going to follow you up closely and try to fix it as soon as possible, because it isn't always that benign. I've seen people, particularly if you have it in both ears, it can really disrupt your balance a lot. I've seen people fall on their face and, get all bruised up, and not to mention people that just can't get out of bed, so they can't go to work or participate in family activities. So it's not so benign, like you said, sometimes. But if the symptoms and signs match up perfectly, then I guess the other reassurance I can give is that it can be cured. You can completely get rid of the positional vertigo. It can come back. What happens is these normal motion sensing calcium protein crystals in the inner ear break down, kind of for unknown reasons, although there may be a connection to vitamin D, but one or more of these little crystals breaks down, and then you've got this debris floating around your inner ear like snow in a snow globe. So the goal of treatment is to get all of this debris out of the semicircular canals of the inner ear where they make you, it makes you very, very dizzy, and return it to the utricle, which is the chamber where it started out, in the hope that it'll be cleared out of the ear from there. And you can do that if you're persistent enough. I've never seen a patient that I couldn't cure, but it can come back, and in which case they call you back and you treat it.
You mentioned migraines. And, as I think about migraines in my own patient panels, it doesn't seem like I would automatically think about dizziness. And I wonder if it's maybe I'm not asking about it enough.
Well, migraine is extremely common. If you look at the criteria, we define migraine in terms of having ever in your life had some headaches with either nausea or excessive light sensitivity that we call photophobia. So and it doesn't matter if it was last week or 5 years ago or 10 years ago, if you've ever had a string of headaches where you had to lie down in a dark room and had nausea and there was no better explanation, and maybe you were diagnosed with migraine back then, if you've ever had migraine, then you always have migraine. So that's the first thing to understand, is it's a sort of a genetically determined brain chemistry that's always there in the background and makes you susceptible to a number of symptoms, headaches the most common. or maybe light sensitivity. But up there on the list of the top 10 symptoms of migraine, it is dizziness, and it's really pretty common, and it doesn't have to be spinning vertigo. It can be other kinds of dizziness, a lightheadedness or a motion sickness is very tightly linked to migraine, I think. But it is very common, and the confusing thing is when people have dizziness and they haven't had a headache for 10 years, trying to tie the two together. And so there are criteria for that. If you can identify a series of typical dizziness episodes that are together with a headache and light sensitivity and nausea all in the same day, then you've got a pretty good confident diagnosis. If not, sometimes if we make that diagnosis, we end up just trying migraine medications and monitoring to see if the person gets better.
You mentioned motion sickness, Dr. Whitman, and that's of a particular interest to me, in part because it seems like there are a lot more people that have that, and it seems like sometimes it interacts with whether or not they had any alcohol the night before. Talk to us a little bit about motion sickness and dizziness and how those things interplay.
Yeah, 24 hours between the bottle and the throttle, I think, is the saying that pilots, have used. Alcohol consumption the night before is probably a risk factor. The thing that I see the most is people who have a background of migraine, they have motion sickness, and when their migraine activity is increased, their motion sickness is increased as well. And one of the reasons I like to identify that pattern is that we have medications for migraine. We have lots of them. We don't have great medications for motion sickness. We've got the over-the-counter ones that everybody knows about, meclizine and dimenhydrinate, Dramamine, and a couple others. But we don't have great preventative medications for motion sickness. So I'm pretty quick to want to identify migraine and see if treating for that will control motion sickness. But we do mostly recommend meclizine and other similar balance system suppressing medications as needed for things like seasickness and air sickness. Actually, one of the most promising treatments was developed at Mount Sinai in New York, and it has to do with throwing a visual pattern on the wall and rotating around the person, kind of like a disco ball type effect, while also turning them physically in a chair. And I think that's very promising, and I don't think, there aren't many people in the world that are interested in continuing that work, but there really should be.
And what about things like that a lot of people swear by, ginger and kind of nutraceuticals? Is there much data on that?
I don't think there's much data on ginger, but I think it's widely agreed by doctors and patients that ginger has some anti-nausea effect. So I think that's an easy one, low risk to identify, to recommend. And, the fresh ginger root is what I like to recommend, to maybe cut that and put it in hot water and make a tea or something like that, because the regular ginger ale that you get usually in the supermarket, it doesn't have that much ginger in it.
And what about medications? You mentioned medications both for treating, but I imagine medications could be a frequent cause of dizziness. How do you, if a patient comes in, they're on 10 different medicines, how do you figure it out?
Yeah, my favorite thing is when I prescribe a medication for maybe migraine or something, the person picks it up at the pharmacy and the pharmacist has slapped a big label on it saying may cause dizziness in capital, 28 point font or something. And I say, yes, I know. Practically every medicine has caused dizziness in someone. So I've started making that disclaimer up front. But yeah, I think anybody who's dizzy and it's not clear what's going on, or even if you think it's clear, it's important to review the medication list and particularly pay attention to things that may have been started around the same time that the person began getting dizzy, because there are a lot of them that commonly cause dizziness. The blood pressure lowering medicines are notorious, because if the blood pressure is too low, you don't get enough blood to your brain, and that'll certainly make you dizzy.
Yeah, I had a patient not too long ago who was talking to me about a whoosh sensation in their brain, and after I heard it about the third time, I realized I wasn't certain what the whoosh sensation was. I said, dizzy? No, not dizzy. So I was just kind of going around, and later on in the visit, the family member said, and by the way, Dr. Goldstein, can you please tell my mother not to take those 10 goody powders a day? And I, all of a sudden, to our listeners, and of course, Dr. Whitman knows this far better than myself, too much of any drug, including aspirin, is not a good thing.
Right.
Well, yep. If you could leave our listeners, Dr. Whitman, with one final piece of advice, other than buy your book, and I know that they can get it probably at any bookstore or Amazon online, and we'll certainly put a link to it on our website, what would your advice be?
Well, I would say, in my clinic, as long as it's approved by your doctor, drinking a little bit of extra water helps a lot of things on the list of common forms of dizziness. And, you know, I would really encourage people also to try to get what we call a working diagnosis from their doctor. I think too often people leave the doctor or the hospital with no idea of what might possibly be going wrong. And I think it's probably good for all of us, doctors and patients, to have the discipline with each visit, actually, to have some kind of a working diagnosis that we come up with so that you can then act on that and test it out or try to treat for it. And yeah, otherwise, it just slows down the progress on improving things.
Well, we really appreciate the really wise approach, I think, which is do no harm, narrow it down, figure it out, reassure, follow up, and make things better. I'm certain that your book, Dizziness, Why You Feel Dizzy and What Will Help You Feel Better, is something that our listeners would enjoy.
Well, thanks, Adam. I appreciate you having me on.
We've been talking with Dr. Greg Whitman about his new book on dizziness. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health. Please stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Laurel and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. Though, Laurel, if any listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We got some comments from listeners today and questions. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today about brittle nails.
So our first listener asks, lately it seems like my nails are very brittle. They break frequently. What could be causing that?
Well, this is a common issue that I think a lot of doctors don't talk about, a lot of patients don't know anything about, but yet it's common. I don't know if you ever had any problem with brittle nails or just different things going on with your nails. A lot of people do. I bite my nails. I used to when I was a kid. I mean, that's a problem.
I bite my nails as well. That's about my only issue with them, but it's a big one.
And a lot of people will have different types of nail disorders, and I think one of the things is, if you really do have a nail disorder, you can certainly talk with your doctor about it. The doctor may or may not know what's going on. A dermatologist frequently specializes in sometimes diseases of the nails, but like things like psoriasis. I'm sure you've seen people with psoriasis and their skin disease. Well, that can affect the nails and make them very brittle. I've seen people with fungal infections. When it happens to the fingernails, they can get a real brittle. The most common reason of a nail being brittle is trauma. Most common trauma is, what do you think, Laurel?
Biting your nails.
Yes, ma'am. That's bingo. Because any trauma to the nail can cause, again, the nail is going to like react to trauma. So if you actually, anyone ever slammed their finger in a door, you notice that nail, or you drop a heavy book on the nail just kind of like gets real dark, painful, it swells and then falls off. So I think, you know, this is not one thing fits all. But yeah, there's a lot of things this can be.
I wonder for the women, too. I'm not sure if this caller was a woman or not, but if you are constantly have your fingernails painted, especially if you're using some of the newer types of polish that don't breathe at all, that might be a reason.
Yeah. In addition to which, there could also be some endocrine problems. So people have thyroid disease can cause brittle nails. So this might be something that some people don't think about. But if you have maybe brittle nails and your hair is really thin and your skin seems a little off and you're kind of cold, I'd go get my thyroid checked. Great question, Laura. What's our very next house call?
Our next listener says, I have an embarrassing question. Quite frequently, I have a lot of gas. My diet usually includes lots of vegetables, and I often make smoothies that are full of good fruit and kale. I know which things cause me to have excessive gas, but a lot of those foods are filled with fiber and very healthy. I don't want to change my eating habits, so is there anything I can do?
Well, thank you for asking a question that probably a lot of people have, but a lot of people don't want to ask about or talk about.
Yeah. I think it's a common issue, and kudos to you for really eating a lot of fruits and vegetables, and seems like you're doing a great job in terms of getting some nutritious food in. This might be the unpleasant side effect of that.
And I think there's some questions between what is normal and what is excessive, because it may be that, you know, you may have not a lot of flatus compared to perhaps or flatulence, or that's what we call gas, the medical terms. We don't call it gas. We call it flatulence. And compared to someone else who has a lot more, but it's not as worrisome to them, because the volume of gas that passes per day out the bottom
can be anywhere from 1/2 to 1.5 liters per day. That seems like a large difference.
That does seem like a lot,
And so that means in someone who's healthy, it can range between 10 and 20 times per day that flatus is released. Now, if the gas has a bad odor to it, 10 times a day could be a real problem versus if it doesn't have much odor, 20 times a day may not be bothersome.
Right.
So I think there's some questions here. It could still be embarrassing, right? Particularly if it's a loud and a noise there. And I don't know, some things that makes me think of is, because I don't eat much meat at all, I'm vegetarian and used to eating legumes and higher fiber, which of course is linked to higher gas, is are you taking in some artificial forms where you may be getting from? So things I'm thinking like sorbitol or some of the sweeteners or some of the things that could be altering your intestinal flora that could be causing you actually to produce more gas. More carbonated beverages are known to produce gas.
That's true. Yeah, a lot of artificial sweeteners. The other thing I might suggest is just kind of spreading it out over the day. So if you're eating, you know, 3 meals a day, maybe considering switching to kind of 5, like smaller meals a day, so you're not getting quite so much fiber all at once. That might be effective.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good idea. I sometimes will have people try a probiotic. It won't hurt. Make sure they're not having reflux of acid problems. They can use over-the-counter simethicone. That helps bind gas and really can help reduce a gas production. And then maybe be evaluated by your provider, either gastroenterologist, primary care physician, for maybe what's called small bowel overgrowth syndrome, some sort of malabsorption that you may need some studies, including checking the pH of your stomach to see what's going on. Obviously, some food avoidance may be helpful, but you're already doing some really good things. So thank you for that great question. We'll actually ask our health sciences librarians maybe to put up some of these common treatments that are maybe recommended for gas. Thank you very much. Laura, what's our very last house call?
Our last one's an interesting question about how can I find out my blood type? What does blood type mean and why does it matter?
Well, I think that's a good question. Most people know that there are blood types, ABO. We kind of, at least that's what was ingrained into me, but what do these things mean? Have you ever given blood, Laurel?
Yes. Yep. Given blood and also given platelets.
Ooh. You got paid for that one, didn't you?
No. Just got to use some work time and go get pampered.
I knew you were gone one day last week. Well, it's great. And we encourage people to give blood, to give platelets. These are really wonderful things. They're life-saving things. And they're safe. And it takes a little bit of time. And where else can you really do great good? In addition to which, you can find out your blood type. You get a blood card after you give.
Actually, I have no idea what mine is.
You don't? Well, you can ask for a blood card. It's in their system. Because they have to test it and to see. And we do know that there's ABO. And what you take home is if you've got one of these types of blood, and for instance, if you have A, you can give to people who have AB blood. You can have ABO or AB. And you can give to people who have A blood. But you can't give people who have B blood. If you have the B blood, you can give someone who has B or has AB. But you can't give, you know, to these people who have O. O, they can give to anyone. They can't really get from anyone other than O. And these AB people, they can get from A, B, or O. But they have a hard time giving to people. So it's, you know, you have to find out, you know, you can give and it's better to give than receive here, but you can only receive from the people that really you can get from. So we're going to put this up there. There's another complicating factor called that plus and minus. Are you A minus or A negative? And basically, it's better to be negative in this particular case because you can give blood to more people than if you're positive. You really can only give blood person who, you know, if you're AB positive, you can only give to someone who's AB positive. But if you're AB negative, you can give someone who's AB negative and AB positive. We'll put both charts up there. You can look it up. Maybe we'll get to give that blood so you can get tested.
It's a good idea.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and that'll conclude what we can talk about on your health. But we hope we've asked questions that are important to you and your health. Send your own questions to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. Our guest today, Dr. Greg Whitman, and I'd like to thank Laurel Siss, our guest co-host today.
Thank you.
We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. And we'll join again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.